This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the U.S., incidents of hate crimes rose in each of the last 3 years, driven by attacks on Jews, Muslims, blacks, and LGBTQ people. Last year, those crimes rose 18% from the previous year. Hate crimes are like ordinary crimes, with the addition of a toxic stew of emotions from anger to fear to indignation. The classification itself hinges on motivation, and in recent years, hate crimes have become the highest priority of the FBI's civil rights program. Charlotte is not immune to these crimes. Just a few weeks ago, a church was defaced with anti-LGBTQ slurs for the seventh time in just the last 3 years. And we have the dubious distinction of ranking near the top in the nation for the number of hate groups active in the community. Hate crimes aren't a new phenomenon. It's our recognition and our condemnation of them that is relatively new, yet they continue to rise. And that's what we're focusing on this hour, the why behind the rise and what is being done to reverse the trend. Ryan Lenz is a senior investigative writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's one of the organizations keeping track of these crimes and the organization that places Charlotte at number 11 on the list of top places in the country where hate organizations are active. Ryan Lenz joins us by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
In our Spirit Square studio is Charlotte attorney Mushtaba Muhammad. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Shane Widmeyer is an author and the LGBTQ campus pioneer and civil rights champion. He's the founder and executive director of Campus Pride, a national LGBTQ organization for student leaders. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you.
Welcome. Ryan, let me start with you. Some people have been blaming Donald Trump for this rise in hate crime, saying through his comments on the campaign trail and since taking office, they are giving a segment of the population permission to say and do what they would have refrained, perhaps, from saying and doing in the past. But the rise in hate crimes actually predates his presidency. So how much, if any, blame should Donald Trump shoulder? How much is coming from other places?
Well, I think a lot of the blame has to, you know, in regards to the president, has to do with the campaign leading up to, you know, the inauguration in January. I mean, we can't forget that in the month following the election in 2016, you know, the country was sort of inundated with reports of bias incidents and hate crimes. We counted almost 1,100 in the month after the election. These were things that we had never seen before. You know, levels of reports that, frankly, were a night and day occurrence for us before January, before November 20th and afterwards.
And you attribute
before November the election.
And you attribute that to things he said on the campaign trail?
Well, in many instances there were references in the actual bias instance that referenced to Trump, you know, like this is, you know, this is Trump's America, things like this. And you know, I think this is a cautionary tale in many ways to point out just what happens when ideologies that are animated by hate and extremism move into the mainstream of American politics.
You are the
and we certainly saw that, by the way, in the election.
Okay. You are the editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch blog. What do you see as some of the other factors that might be contributing to the rise of these hate crimes nationally?
Well, I think we also have to acknowledge that this is a global issue. You know, we are seeing the rise of ethnic nationalism across the world, driven in large part by, you know, concerns of globalism, concerns of, you know, of nationalist identity and so on. Immigration and the refugee crisis of 2016 and 2015 has animated a lot of people into action, and certainly has, you know, has driven them into, you know, when their crimes are animated by fear of the other, that's certainly a factor.
And because we have this global media now where we can see almost instantly what's going on in other parts of the world, does this feed on itself? In other words, if we see rising nationalism in Germany or some other country in America, do we then see that as a sign that it's okay for us to act similarly and vice versa?
Well, I think one of the lessons that we can take away from the recent years is that the world is much smaller than it used to be. You know, what happens in say Germany or France happens in real time in the United States as well. And we have seen sort of the ideas that have animated this xenophobic hatred crisscross the Atlantic through message boards, through extremist organizations that share ideas and ideas on how to present themselves in the public sphere. So I think that in many ways, you know, it's not necessarily who caused what, but it's which countries are sort of falling to this ethnic populist nationalism and which are sort of holding strong.
Mujtaba Muhammad is a public is a Charlotte attorney here in Charlotte. Do you defend a lot of clients who have had problems along these areas?
So thankfully, in our office, we haven't had these issues where we're having to defend folks who have committed these types of acts. But as Ryan mentioned earlier, he talked about the leading up to the presidential campaign. Politicians, elected officials, the president of the United States, they're supposed to be role models, right? They're paving the way for our children and our families. And when you have elected officials or people like President Trump starting this birtherism movement, the day he launched his campaign, the way he spoke about Mexican-Americans and undocumented individuals, calling them rapists and murderers, and the way he's spoken about the Muslim community, it's this constant track record of telling people it's okay to behave this way. And America is a world leader. America is a world leader. So when we have our president of the United States who justifies the type of xenophobic hatred that he does on the campaign trail as a candidate and now as a president of the United States, that allows other countries, other government leaders to do the same thing in those countries. And that's what we're seeing on social media, that circles are becoming smaller and smaller. It's easier to see what things are happening.
Define hate crime, since you're the attorney in the room. Define hate crime. What constitutes it?
Hate crimes are basically when you take a minority group of individuals based on religion, gender identity, sexual orientation, or race, and you're basically attacking them. It could be in a violent way. It could be vandalism. It could be hateful rhetoric. And you're making them feel isolated and a feel of loss of trust.
Is that true in all 50 states? I know we have federal laws that govern this, but we also have 50 states, and they have state laws, and five of those states do not mention certain aspects of certain segments of the population who are protected.
So it's my understanding majority of the states across the United States have laws on the books against hate crimes. We have federal legislation as well. The problem is that in a lot of states, and North Carolina is one of them, where we don't recognize gender identity and sexual orientation.
Correct.
That's another segment of our population, the LGBTQ community, who is facing hate crimes. There's been a rise in hate crimes with the LGBT community, Muslim Americans, and all these different groups, but we've got to expand our coverage of the people that are not being covered and protected.
Some people have said, because they've said it on this program, that a crime is a crime, and there's no reason to call something a hate crime because a crime is a crime. It doesn't matter the motivation. Why does the motivation matter? Why does it matter that somebody did something because they have prejudice, bias, hatred against that other segment of the population?
Well, like I was telling you earlier, Mike, hate crimes are not just about the physical toll that it might take on that particular individual or that community. But the problem is when segments of that community begin to feel isolated or alone, that's the problem. When a hate crime happens and we tell our community, you know what, as government officials, as law enforcement, we're not taking this seriously. This allows other people to act on that hate and jump on that bandwagon and continue that ugly process of hate.
Shane Windmeyer's here. He's the executive director and founder of Campus Pride, which is an organization, as I said at the beginning of the program, that deals with LGBTQ concerns on campuses across North Carolina and, I guess, across the country. Would I be right
correct
in saying that? When you look at the America of 2018 and compare it to this country 40 years ago, great strides seem to have been made in the ability of LGBTQ people to live an open life and live authentic lives. When you look at this country today versus 50 or 60 years ago, the same can be said about African Americans who achieved the civil rights and have taken great strides, although there's much to be done. I'm just saying they've taken great strides. But then you look at the rise in hate crimes in recent years. So when you compare these statistics to that, are we just kidding ourselves? Have we made progress?
Well, I think it is. It's regional. It's sometimes based on the state or the city that you live in as far as you measure progress. And LGBTQ people are not monolithic in how we look at them. We have people who are transgender within the LGBTQ umbrella or non-binary. And so it's very hard to say LGBTQ and see us as one people. And we also live intersectional lives. And so these same LGBTQ people who are victims of maybe a bias incident or a hate crime crime because of their sexuality or their gender identity may also be victims because of their race, because they happen to be people of color, or because of their religion, because they happen to be Muslim. And so we have to look at this in an intersectional approach as far as how we approach hate crimes and how we look at the LGBTQ community here in Charlotte as well as across the U.S. Mm. Campus Pride has been working for over 15 years on college campuses with a program called Stop the Hate. And it actually is a collaboration project we started with the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, and a number of other partners to prevent bias and hate crimes from happening on college campus communities. And it's not just about LGBTQ. It really looks at race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, gender identity, religion. And it looks at it from a standpoint of, let's start with the bias incident, right? The things that may not be criminal, but are still creating an environment where a hate crime can occur and likely will occur if you allow bias incidents to fester and create a community that is negative. And that's where I think we really need to change our focus and look at what is the bias that people in our communities have toward someone who's a person of color, and what stimulates that bias in a way that is negative. What happened at Wedgwood Baptist Church here in Charlotte? You know, I live less than six blocks from that church. And, you know, it's really a sometimes baffling to think about what motivates someone to vandalize and to do it in a way that is a hate crime because of the biased language that they use. And I think we have to go back to all the turmoil and all the issues that we confront on a daily basis still after HB2 here in Charlotte. It's not a surprise that, you know, my husband and I, you know, are fearful at night in certain parts of Charlotte because we are two gay men. And so you don't just live in a world that is free of bias automatically. It takes time. It takes, you know, allies to stand up and to help create that community and tell their young child, you know, that joke that you made is not appropriate. And we sadly have a child in the presidency who makes jokes all the time and harasses people. Mm-hmm. And those are bias incidents that create an environment that it's likely to have a hate crime.
It may not be possible to answer this question because it's impossible to prove a negative, but are things scarier today? Are they worse today? Are they better today than perhaps they would have been for the LGBTQ community 40 years ago when people were pretty much not open about it?
Well, we are fighting for social justice and for civil rights. And so anytime you have a fight that is visible, you're going to have people who are in harm's way. And so the more visibility you have, the more chance you have of harm. And that's why I think we need to have more allies and people who are speaking out on behalf of all of our communities, our immigrant communities here in Charlotte, our LGBTQ communities, and realizing that we're all in this together. The reason why hate crimes are devastating as a crime, and a crime isn't a crime is a crime, we have learned throughout history that hate crimes are bad, and we have not learned our history, or else we would realize that anything that is striking at someone for who they are is, you know, the antithesis of what being an American is about. And so we should be celebrating that diversity. And a hate crime hits at a community, tears it apart. It's not about just one person getting robbed. It's about an entire community being assaulted.
In 2017, the Southern Poverty Law Center counted more than 1,300 hate incidents, your words, across the country. That would tell me that not all of these were crimes. I have 20 seconds, Ryan. Give me an example of an incident versus a crime.
An incident would be, let's look at a school, which I think is the most terrifying instance, where I can't remember the location, but there was a group of students who built a cardboard wall in the halls of their middle school, and started harassing Hispanic and Latino students.
And with that, I have to stop you. We'll come back and finish that story in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rise in hate crimes here and around the country with Mushtaba Muhammad, a Charlotte attorney, Shane Windmeyer, executive director and founder of Campus Pride, and Ryan Lenz, senior investigative writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center. I asked you a question that you could not answer, Ryan, in the time allotted, so let me let you take a crack at it again. I mentioned that in 2017, last year, the Southern Poverty Law Center counted more than 1,300 hate incidents as opposed to crimes, and I asked you to give me one example of an incident versus a crime, and you were in the middle of that, so finish that story.
I was describing an incident at a school, I believe it was in Texas, where students had started harassing some of their Hispanic and Latino counterparts by building a wall made of cardboard boxes and screaming epithets at them as they entered the school. That was included in a separate report of ours on sort of hate as it was manifesting itself in school districts and in schools. I think one of the larger and sort of more prominent instances outside of schools that terrified us as to what was happening was the rash of bomb threats against Jewish community centers. There were 57 separate incidents in 24 states.
Is that not a crime? Is the threat of that not a crime?
Well, the threat of that is a crime, of course. You know, if you call and threaten to blow up a building, that is, of course, a crime. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then you can get into, well, is it a crime to scream racial epithets at someone running down the street? And that then gets into the sort of really murky realities of what hate crimes are. Because hate crimes are, you know, as we heard earlier in the show, you know, they are attacks on a community of people based on an immutable characteristic, something they can't change. But there's sort of really murky grounds as to how that law is applied, not just in which states don't have it, but in states that have it too, because it ultimately comes down to prosecutors' prerogative. Is it beneficial, or do they want to pursue a hate crime designation in a crime? Is it beneficial to them to do so?
Why would they not want to?
Well, for example, let's look at Dylann Roof, okay? Dylann Roof, if you convict him of the counts of murder that he faced, he would never see the light of day. Now, when you apply a hate crime designation to a crime, it ultimately is a sentencing caveat. It creates a larger and bigger sentence for someone if they're convicted of the crime. So if it's a murder charge, a prosecutor might say to themselves, well, I don't really want to pursue this as a hate crime because it's an additional barrier I have to overcome in convincing a jury of their motivation when all I ultimately have to do to put this person behind bars for the rest of their life is convince this jury that they're guilty of the crime, of the act. So that's where we get into really complicated, sort of murky areas when it comes to hate crimes and getting a solid feel as to how thoroughly pervasive they are across the country.
Mike, what I will say, part of the reason we're not prosecuting more hate crimes is because people don't know about them, right? The FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, it's a voluntary program, first of all, with only 15,000 law enforcement agencies across the United States. That means there are thousands of agencies, law enforcement agencies, not participating in that program. Even if in that program, that report is only for 1 to 2 months, not for a consistent one entire year. So there's so many reports that are being underreported, and that's the thing. We're not prioritizing it.
And according to the Voice of America, these in many cases, the reporting to the FBI from police departments around the country is voluntary. They don't have to report these crimes to the FBI.
That's the problem, especially with certain states. But if you look at states like California, who are on the front of this, or Connecticut, they have laws on the books that are mandatory reporting for law enforcement agencies, where they work with their attorney general's office. They have a process in place where they report this to the DOJ and the FBI. But places like North Carolina and other states, they don't have a mandatory process, which is why a lot of these hate crimes are underreported, and that's the problem.
So CNN reports that two social scientists in Boston in the 90s examined hate crime case files at the Boston Police Department and found that there are four main kinds of these crimes and those who commit them, thrill seekers, defenders, retaliators, and mission offenders. I'm not sure how this, if everybody in this conversation would agree with those classifications, but let's go through those four categories in case you do. Thrill seekers are just that. There's no reason that they commit these crimes other than for the thrill of doing the act, the excitement, the drama. Defenders, however, see themselves as defending their turf. Is that where the white supremacist movement gets its legs?
Again, we talked about the internet and the social media and people nowadays especially living in their own bubbles. So when they feel when something happens, breaking news or something around the world happens, and they feel like as if, hey, I need to do something. I need to take a bold step. I need to come after the Muslim American community. Mm-hmm. I need to go after Jewish Americans or the LGBT community because, hey, they're taking away our way of life, quote unquote, right? That's the problem. It's that constant festering. And if you look at social media, I try to avoid certain things. If you look at certain news articles and web blogs, people support those ideas. People will encourage those ideas. So it only takes one person to grab a gun or do something crazy and hurt lots of people.
So the other category.
Can I jump in on that point?
Sure, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, on that defender's point, you know, in recent years, you know, we have seen, especially in the final term of the Obama administration, we saw this idea of white genocide, for example, start to explode across the country. This idea that there was a systematic effort to push multicultural policies at the detriment of the white race, quote unquote, right? It was an expansively popular thing, and it started to animate people. And so a lot of times when you see people out there, you know, like some 65-year-old man's, you know, like attacking a Muslim woman, you know, he sees himself as a defender of American's heritage, right? Furthermore, let's expand this to anti-LGBT hate crimes. The attack on the trans community in America is just heartbreaking. And in a lot of ways, you know, that defender, these people see themselves as defenders of quote unquote traditionalism, you know, the way it used to be before people were granted civil rights. And so, I mean, it's again, you know, sort of this expansive sort of defenders of their turf, I think, is a little short-sighted, more defenders of a way of life that they feel America is supposed to be.
Well, that goes to the mission offenders, it seems to me also, because they they're the rarest group, at least according to these social scientists in Boston. They see themselves as crusaders for a cause, often racial or religious, and it is their mission, a total war against people of that sect that they're angry at, is their mission. That sounds very much like terrorism to me.
Well, I would argue that you're exactly right. It is terrorism, and it's a domestic terrorism. The most classic form of the most classic case when we talk about a mission offender is Benjamin Smith from a number of years ago, a young man who was a college student at University of Illinois who got transferred to Indiana University. And it was on his judicial record that he was going around at University of Illinois and passing out flyers. And these flyers would have, you know, racial epithet, just horrible, horrific things. And when he transfers, your judicial record doesn't transfer with you immediately to a campus. So Indiana University was unaware, and Benjamin Smith was highly influenced by hate groups, and it was, you know, it was his life calling to basically do this, is how he saw it. Hmm. And he was motivated by Matthew Hale, people who follow hate crimes and this type of stuff would know, or hate groups would know who Matthew Hale is. But the point is that Benjamin Smith went on a rampage shooting dozens of people, and that's the type of mission offender you have.
I would say that this is why experts say that public officials need to denounce hate crimes quickly and strongly in no uncertain terms, because if they don't, the fervor of the perpetrator can spread fairly quickly through the community at large. Why do people, if it's not denounced, suddenly feel, well, gee, that's a good idea. I think I'll join in.
Well, that's the problem. Behind every message of a hate crime is, hey, you don't belong here. You're not one of us. Please go away. We're going to scare you, right? But every strong committee, the community's message, that response is, yes, you are, and this is what we're going to do about it. We're going to immediately speak out against it. We need to make these certain reforms to make sure that these things don't happen again, and to tell folks that are wanting to perpetrate these acts of hate that, hey, you're not welcome. This type of behavior is not welcome. This is not part of our society here.
So what's the impact, Ryan, when the president of the United States, following the incident in Charlottesville, says there were good people on both sides of the conflict? What's the impact of that?
Well, I mean, I think it does quite a lot to normalize the type of speech and, for that matter, the dogma behind racist ideologies. You know, there were good people. I don't know how you can rationalize that people who were standing up and willing to inflict violence on other people in defense of, say, white heritage or the Confederacy or these sorts of things. That's not a good person to me. These are horrible realities of American history that are not defendable. We have to acknowledge them as sort of the shameful realities of our inheritance. But they're not people that stand up to attack multiculturalism or to rob the rights of other people are not good people.
In statistics kept by the FBI from 1995 through 2014, I hate numbers on the radio, but I have to give out some numbers here. The vast number of these crimes were race-based, followed by crimes against certain religions and their followers, and very closely behind that, crimes based on sexual orientation. Crimes based on race had been cut almost in half from 1995 through 2014, while those based on religion and sexual orientation declined by only a small amount. If these numbers are rising now, how and why did they decline prior to 2015, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I there are sort of anecdotal ideas or sort of cultural trends I could say that were responsible for that. But let's look at this. You know, in 2008, when President Obama was elected, okay, the entire country was sort of amazed. You know, this was the first African-American president the country had ever elected. And there was a lot of thought about what this meant for us. You know, questions from the American punditry. Do we finally live in a post-racial, multicultural, a truly equal America now that this has happened? There was endless rumination about this. 8 years later, when President Trump was elected on a platform of populist nationalism that, you know, had swept across the country, it came in the wake of Brexit and the United Kingdom, and it came in the midst of a refugee crisis across the globe, the answer was distinct. We do not live in a post-racial America. And so in that period of time, you know, in those 8 years of the Obama administration, so many people on the far right became enraged with what they saw. You know, there were expansive rights being granted to the LGBT community. You know, there was a black man in the White House. And these sorts of things drove people into fury. So with the election, night and day, it starts to happen. You know, we start to see people seeing that they finally might have a green light to act out on their impulses. And I think that's what we're starting to see.
And I do want to say, and that green light has been President Trump. Right?
Yeah.
Years ago, we saw men that would cover their faces in sheets with flames. But now they've become so emboldened that we see these same people in Charlottesville without any sheets on their face, right, with flames, saying that same type of rhetoric.
Is this generational, Shane? You work with young people on college campuses. Are these various hatreds, race, religion, sexual orientation, are they generational? Is it changing as young people come to the fore? Or are they learning, because you have to be carefully taught, are they learning that those same prejudices that their parents and grandparents perhaps held?
Well, I do think that there's been a change in the attitudes of younger generations, and I think that has evolved into what is seen as a kind of a progressive generation of millennials who are really understanding what social justice is about and living their lives intersectionally. I do think, though, that, you know, the paradigm shift that I see is that we need to start dealing with behavior that is not criminal but is prejudicial, mm-hmm, and standing up to that, because that's what breeds the environment for hate crimes to actually occur. And until we do that in our communities, and, you know, if somebody – it is not tolerated in most circles to make a racial epitaph or a racial slur. It is still tolerated today to make a transgender joke or toward somebody who might be gay. And so we need to find that out. And I say that very, very largely. I'm sure there's some circles where it is tolerated. But, you know, largely in our society, we need to not tolerate any biased language, whether or not it be their First Amendment right. They can say what they want. And I think it was Morris Dees who said with the Southern Poverty Law Center, people have the right, you know, to hate, but they don't have the right to hurt someone based on that hate. Mm. And we need to come together as a community and understand that our language, you know, this coded language that the Trump administration uses constantly, does incite and does embolden people to express their prejudicial views in ways that are harmful and that just give permission to young people. Because I think that's what scares me today, is there's a lot of permission being given through what we call leaders or leadership that I hadn't seen, in, you know, maybe a decade or two before doing this work, a lot of campuses after Trump was elected, you know, they're still dealing with a lot of hate crimes that are around race, that are around, you know, immigrant communities because of what's being said on the national stage.
Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools recently approved a new revised multiculturalism policy, which expands the definition of diversity to include sexual orientation and gender identity and expression, along with attributes like race and gender and national origin and religion. Do these kinds of policies, in your experience, I don't know who to ask this question of, actually do things? Does it have an impact? Does it change the trajectory of all of this?
Well, it has to start there, right? I mean, if you don't have a policy in place, then how can you enforce anything?
But it also, there was some opposition to the CMS passing that change in their policy. Does when the opposition loses, as they did here, does that serve to increase, amp up the frustration and hatred?
As I said earlier, I think any time that you're in a battle for someone's civil rights, more visibility, you're going to have potential for more harm. That is a sad reality of any time you have visibility in a community. That happened with HB2. One of my biggest concerns with HB2 was the amount of harassment that our trans people were experiencing, not because all of a sudden they had done something wrong or that they were, but we put them out there as visible, right, you know, pawns in this chess game. So, I mean, I think you have to start with the policy. That's what we tell campuses. There are only 25%, roughly 28% of college campuses in this country that have sexual orientation as part of its non-discrimination statement. People don't know that, right? It's not even a majority of higher education that have a basic policy that says that they don't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation.
And when you bring this up to college campuses or to the campuses that don't have this, what's their reaction? Do they act like, what are you talking about? Why do we need this? Are they saying, we'll consider this? What are they saying to you?
It depends on the type of campus. I think the campuses today, with the exception of some private religious campuses, want to be seen as gay-friendly. They want to be seen as compassionate toward gay people. The challenge is that unless you have a policy, unless you have programs that support somebody who's coming out on your campus, you're not a environment where I would send an out gay student or even one who comes out. Would I want my son or daughter on your campus?
So the Southern Poverty Law Center has ranked Charlotte as number 11 in the listing of top cities in the country for the number of hate groups actively operating. When we come back, Ryan, I'd like you to talk about these groups, who they are, why they feel free to operate here, and how we made the top 11. That seems like a dubious distinction. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about hate crimes. Mushtaba Muhammad is with us. He is a Charlotte attorney. Shane Windmeyer is executive director and founder of Campus Pride. And Ryan Lentz is senior investigative writer with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which named or ranked Charlotte number 11 in the listing of top cities in the country for the number of hate groups actively operating. Who are these groups, Ryan, and what kinds of things are they doing?
In North Carolina, there are 30. Well, let me say a couple of things about this. There are these are the numbers from 2017. 2016. The numbers for 2017 will be released in a matter of weeks now. In North Carolina, among the 917 hate groups nationwide, there were 31. These are groups that include neo-Nazi organizations, neo-Confederate organizations. It goes on, Ku Klux Klan organizations, and so on. It's important to note that this dubious distinction that North Carolina has, the state is certainly not alone, and it is part of sort of a geographic reality. Hate groups tend to congregate or populate states with larger populations and more diverse populations. You would think it's sort of counterintuitive, because you would think that states that are predominantly white would be the places that would be most active in defending sort of white citizens, white identity. But that is actually not true. States that are more diverse, or cities and towns and counties that are more diverse, tend to be where hate groups congregate and target their activities. Why? Well, there have been a lot of psychological and sociological studies that have found that that it is when that people, when they experience diversity, there is at you know there is it's called Bowling Alone is the name of the book, where they sort of congregate in their own sort of enclaves, and it is in that sort of reality or that milieu that hate groups think or hope that they'll have the best chance of recruiting membership.
Your group is keeping track of these organizations. Is law enforcement?
As far as we know, no. It is illegal for law enforcement to monitor a citizen or an organization without probable cause. Mm-hmm. There has to be a suspicion of criminality involved. For them to justify continued observation of an organization or person, we can. You know, because we are academics and researchers, journalists and others who want to know where these people are, because we believe that these ideas, these ideologies that drive the far right have no place in a functioning democracy, and certainly not in the 21st century.
So, Shane, you referenced the crime that occurred recently at the Wedgwood Baptist Church, which was defaced. The front door, I think, was painted with a slur. And the Reverend Chris Ayers is the pastor at Wedgwood Church. I'm going to play his comment about this and just warn people that there may be a word or two in his comment that you might find offensive.
The incident happened right here on front of the church doors. This is the second time our church doors have been vandalized. The first time, a couple years ago, they spray-painted fags or pedos, and this time, whoever did it spray-painted fags or pedophiles. Misspelled pedophiles, but that's what they meant. We've had actually seven vandalisms at the church. Six of those seven were related to sexual orientation and gender identity. The other was in respect to racism. We had stop killing, disrespecting black people, black bodies on our sign, and someone put a racist note on there along with a shotgun shell.
The person that left the shotgun shell taped at the door in 2016 later confessed. This is a gay-friendly church, and the pastor says this is related to the broader education of the homophobic community. Would you agree with that? Education is what's required here?
Oh, most definitely. Education is required, and vigilance is required for the community to stand up, not just in that area, but across Charlotte, and for the faith community to stand up alongside Wedgwood Baptist. I mean, we were mentioning earlier how important it is to have a response. You know, on college campuses, immediately after a bias crime, a hate crime happens, the president needs to come out and speak. He or she, it's very important that they do that. And same way here in Charlotte, we need to speak as one voice and condemn this across our communities.
You're like the walking epitome of somebody who might be targeted. And I say this because you are an American Indian from the Iowa tribe. Your family is mixed race Mexican. You have a little bit of Irish in you, and the Irish have been acted against in the early part of the 20th century. And you are gay. How often in your life have you felt targeted by hatred?
Well, I think that for my own personal story, it's been about my effeminacy, being comfortable with not being masculine, that has been more targeted than me passing as white, because largely in most circles I'm able to pass. And we talk about privilege, and you know, I'm privileged to be able to as a gay man, be able to decide how I share that usually. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that's hard for some people to think, well, you know, anyone can be a victim of a hate crime, first of all. But secondly, when they think about themselves, you know, all it takes is being in the wrong place at the wrong time. We help run a restaurant here in Charlotte that has a bunch of drag queens, right? And it's a fun place. All it takes is, you know, somebody being along that block where a bunch of gay bars are, restaurants are. You can be a victim of a hate crime for being perceived to be homosexual or bisexual or transgender. And so it's not just about the actual, it's about being perceived. And so, you know, I always try to think about, where my privilege lies as opposed to where I might be victimized. And I think that's how we all should live. And we should just be vigilant and stand up for others when it does happen.
Mujtaba Muhammad, crimes against Muslims in America rose precipitously after 9/11. And you say that the community has been particularly hard hit in recent days, in the recent rise in hate crimes. What is the climate in Charlotte for followers of Islam?
So you're absolutely right, Mike. After September 11th, the hate crimes went up huge. And then after Donald Trump's election and then leading up to his election, hate crimes against Muslims went up to 67%. Thankfully, I will tell you, there's a reason why I love Charlotte, North Carolina. It's been my home for a number of years. Our community is a strong community. We've always had a city council and a government who has always been more progressive and bold when it comes to saying that these types of acts are not going to be tolerated here. Charlotte Montgomery Police Department has always done a fantastic job. But what I can tell you, we're coming up on a three-year anniversary of where three young Muslim students in Chapel Hill, right here in North Carolina, were murdered in their home, execution style. The couple, 23 and 21, Dia and Yusser, they're newlyweds, just starting their life as dental students. The younger sister, Razan, who's only 19 years old, an engineering student, I believe, at NC State, their lives ended tragically that day because partly due to these hate crimes.
It was incredibly shocking when that happened, not only because it happened, but because it happened in Chapel Hill, of all places, and not terribly far from Charlotte. As of yesterday's show, we talked about Chapel Hill being in our backyard. But that's the most heinous incident of that we know about. So is there comfort to be taken in that it only happened once 3 years ago?
Listen, as a Muslim American, as a leader in our community, I can tell you Muslim Americans right now under this current climate are terrified. It's not an easy way to live your life when you're already dealing with life's problems and then now you're having to look over your shoulder. You know, now we have shootings at churches. You know, Muslim mosques and centers have had to ramp up security. They've had to work more with law enforcement because they're worried about something terrible happening. Even right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, mosques have been firebombed. Excuse me, not in Charlotte, but in other parts of the state. You've had places like Texas and Arizona where armed men, like we talked about, the Defenders or the mission type of hate crime groups, have been standing armed outside places of worship, intimidating children, women, and the elderly. This is the ugly fact that we're dealing with right now.
The Jewish community in Charlotte has also experienced this. There were three hate crimes against the Jewish family in Steel Creek late last year. And I know, Ryan, that the Southern Poverty Law Center has been keeping statistics on anti-Latino hate crimes as well, alongside the rise of active hate groups. What do those statistics look like? Is there a Charlotte component or a North Carolina component to those numbers?
I actually don't have those numbers readily at my hand, but I will tell you this, that rise in anti-Latino sort of intimidation and bias attacks is certainly tied directly to immigration returning to the debate, and immigration returning to the national debate with a particularly hard right perspective. The White House, for example, has a lot of ties to hard right anti-immigrant hate groups, and that is not without coincidence that we should see this sort of corollary again.
Does law enforcement, Mujtaba, and because you're in the legal system here, does law enforcement, does the FBI, the local police, do they do enough to investigate these instances of hate crimes or threats or the fears that people may feel with foundation or without foundation? Do they look into it at all?
And this is what a lot of civil rights advocates are talking about. This is what we talked about earlier. If law enforcement isn't tracking the data, then how are we going to solve a problem? If we don't recognize that our problem is existing, then how are we going to take it seriously? And that's been the problem across North Carolina and across the country. We need law enforcement to step up. Their job is to protect the most vulnerable, and they're not going to do that if they're not taking these incidents seriously and thoroughly investigating them.
Same question to you, Shane, with regard to the LGBTQ community.
Well, I think that here in Charlotte locally, my experience has been is you have to bring it up to the officer in order for them to understand that there might be a bias motivation behind a crime. I think that's very true of Charlotte. They're not going to automatically think, well, this happened at a gay establishment of some kind. well, what was the motivation? Like, they're not going to go there. It causes them more time, more energy, more resources. And that's, I think, why we're talking about this today, is because, you know, those numbers from the FBI, I mean, they're underreported. And one reason why they're underreported is, you know, officers don't have the resources or the time, or aren't making the resources or the time available to be able to track these realistically.
And in November of last year, the Washington Post reported that even as the incidences of hate crimes rose, there were, quote, so many gaping holes in the data that it is difficult, if not impossible, to ascertain the true scope of bias-related crimes in America or where most hate crimes are being committed. And it is impossible to conclude that hate crimes are being prosecuted on a large scale. Let me repeat that, since I stumbled through it. It is impossible to conclude that hate crimes are being prosecuted on a large scale. So, Ryan, have there been any calls for closing this knowledge gap?
Yes, there have. You know, of course, there is. You know, there. When we're talking about hate crimes overall, we're talking about a very murky reality. We're talking about sort of education, and we're talking about reporting, and we're also talking about ensuring sort of uniformity across the across the country. I think that the current time, you know, such as the world is right now, it's drawing a lot of people's attention toward hate crimes and wishing, you know, and asking for them to make some sort of serious look at what's going on. I don't know how that will move forward. You know, there are serious barriers in the Justice Department and elsewhere in regards to actually pushing hate crimes into the mainstream or hate crime as education. You know, we're hopeful.
Mushtaba, how easy or difficult is it to get a conviction in court against perpetrators, or is that the goal?
Well, in North Carolina, hate crimes are generally an aggravating factor. There's not a presumptive punishment for that. Generally, it's very difficult to prove. In cases like in Chapel Hill right now, if they're seeking the death penalty, doesn't get worse than that, that type of punishment. But it is a bit difficult. But again, through tracking the process, acknowledging that these issues exist, that's how we're going to be able to tackle these problems.
It seems that this is another instance where you take a step forward and you take three steps back, because as people like in the LGBT community have made advances to the point where they feel that they can live openly, where marriage has been granted, etc., you would think that that's a great stride forward and the sun is shining and everything is rosy, the flowers are blooming. But the New York Times reports that GLAAD, the media advocacy group for LGBTQ people, released their accelerating acceptance survey at the recent World Economic Forum in Davos, and that poll revealed that for the first time since the poll began, support for LGBTQ people has dropped in every category. Is that what normally happens, or is this something particular to the LGBTQ community?
So I actually predicted this a while back when we gained marriage equality. Obviously, my husband and I, we've been together 24 years now, and we've been married 4 of those years officially. If we had children, one of my big concerns was that you know, for the longest time, a straight family didn't have to see our families. They could ignore that they existed or that they were real. Now with marriage, we're actually seeing, you know, gay people, lesbian, bisexual people, you know, living their lives fully. And that means showing up at school with 2 dads. And, you know, if you think about that, or 2 moms or whatever your family structure is, and having to explain that to your son or daughter. And a lot of straight people don't want to do that, right? Like, they're like, well, we didn't think that was part of gay marriage, right? But I think that's the reality. And I think that's what a lot of people are seeing, is that, you know, we have always been there, but giving us legal rights means that we can be protected and legal with our families. And I think that's been some of the backlash, or at least some of the concerns. And I hear from my straight friends all the time, well, you have marriage equality, you're able to do whatever you want. I'm like, we still don't have the legal right to keep our jobs. We don't still have legal rights around housing protection, right? Like, there's a lot of other civil rights that are still not available to LGBTQ people across the nation.
And plus, the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, and black people are still fighting for their,
exactly,
for their rights for full citizenship.
Mike, I just want to say, diversity has always been America's strength. It's always been the strength of North Carolina. And we've got to do more, especially in our legislature, to expand protections for our most vulnerable, especially when it comes to people with different sexual orientation and gender identity. There's bills in committee right now on working on that, and hopefully North Carolina can get it done.
Mushtaba Mohammed, a Charlotte attorney, Shane Windmeyer, also with us, executive director and founder of Campus Pride, and Ryan Lenz, senior investigative writer with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thank you all for the hour.